Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Welcome to Lucas Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start, I want to remind you that KBOO is funded by you, the listener. Please show your support for this amazing community resource by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. At the end of this month, the World Forestry Center is sponsoring a conference called Who Will Own the Forests? For forest conservationists, that's a good question. Today we talk with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer for the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about how to shift the emphasis back to putting forests over profits and maximizing the urgency to make climate resilience our number one concern as we struggle to save our planet. Alex, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I want to mention, for those of you who actually read the emails I send out every week about the show or check our website, Brenna Bell was supposed to come on today, and we're going to be talking about a bit of a broader view about forests and some of the bills that are threatening our forests in the state legislature and also locally here in Portland. Brenna let me know yesterday that she has COVID, so she's not here today, and she'll be on sometime next month. So anyway, I really want to appreciate Alex for stepping in last minute, and I'm actually very excited about what we're going to be talking about, because Brenna would step, well, she was going to sort of touch on this, but when I started reading the information you sent me yesterday, Alex, I realized this is really crucial. So we're going to be talking today about this conference that's going to be happening on September 26th to 28th at the World Forestry Center called Who Will Own the Forests? So, Alex, who's going to be at that conference?
Well, it's a long list. I looked this morning at the list of attendees, and currently there's about 150 different companies and organizations that are planning to be there. And by and large, mainly it will be institutional timberland investors. But it also includes carbon offsetting and net zero focused companies, biomass companies, international investment and global financialization companies, climate risk and insurance companies. They're going to be also talking about the Farm Bill. There's major accounting firms like KPMG. So it's a who's who of folks involved, big polluters and the folks driving both deforestation around the world and the climate crisis.
So what do you think they mean by that title, Who Will Own the Forests?
I think they're saying the quiet part out loud. I think, you know, this is geared towards, and we can get into this a little bit more maybe, but there's been a large shift in the timber industry away from kind of the traditional, fully integrated, locally based timber companies to what are called REITs and TIMOs, which are these elaborately structured investment firms that minimize the taxes they have to pay and maximize profits. So the Conference Who Will Own the Forest is really, it's about that. It's about expanding corporate ownership of forest lands and squeezing every drop of profit that they can from the land. And that's very much their focus.
Well, when we were talking last night, you mentioned that a lot of the focus of the forest activists and conservationists has been on public land.
That's right.
However, meanwhile, over the last 50, 60, 100 years, what goes on in private lands is pretty much nobody's business except the owner of the land itself. So are these is this conference focusing on private lands, or do they also look at how private interests can also encroach on public lands?
I mean, I'm sure there's always some overlap. You know, those categories don't stay quite as separate as we tend to talk about them. The conference is going to have sessions about the Farm Bill and other regulatory things that are in the air in the forest and climate world right now, politically and in legislatures, I think mainly federally in the U.S., but also around the world. But it is much more focused on the privately owned timberlands. And like you said, for decades, the forest conservation movement, the forest defense movements have been really focused on public lands. And I think that's really important work. There's a lot of old growth that would be gone. We wouldn't have hardly any old growth left. I mean, we still are only have a fraction left in the Pacific Northwest and around the world of old growth primary forests left. And in the U.S., those forests are mostly on public lands. So it's really important that folks in the conservation forest defense movement have been doing that work. But at the same time, you know, in Oregon, the timber industry is the largest source of climate pollution that we have. It's larger than transportation. It's larger than electricity generation. So if we're looking at the climate crisis that we're facing and where we need to make cuts to emissions, we need to be talking about the timber industry. And there's a lot of potential there. Our forests can also be a vital solution to the climate crisis. Right now, the way forests are managed, they're managed for profit, not for carbon storage and sequestration. So currently they're a major source of emissions, the largest in Oregon, but they could be a major carbon sink. And I think that's not true of a lot of, you know, other sources of emissions. When we're talking about like oil and gas, we need to obviously stop burning fossil fuels. But stop burning fossil fuels isn't going, you know, those aren't going to turn into carbon negative sources, and forests have that potential. In Oregon, like I said, the timber industry is the largest source of climate pollution, and 70% of the logging happens on private lands. So while it's really important that we're protecting old growth on our public lands, where most of it still is left, from a climate perspective, we need to be dramatically reforming private forestry.
Now, why is it that forestry practices produce so much carbon emissions?
I think it's widely understood, certainly here in the Northwest, that forests store lots of carbon. They're made of wood. Trees are made of wood. Obviously, wood is mostly carbon. But I think the actual carbon cycle is a little bit more complex than that. So the most of the carbon that's stored in a forest is not stored in trees. It's not even above ground. Most of the carbon in forests is below ground, in the soil, in roots, in mycelium. And when you cut the trees down, I mean, first of all, forests are more than just trees. There's lots of other plants there. They're complex ecosystems. And logging, especially the way we do it today, and it's even more so on private lands where it's just clear-cut logging, everything is cleared off the surface. And then that the use of these heavy machines compacts the soil. That releases the carbon from the soil, even the carbon that's left in roots and things, and the woody debris, the slash that's left from logging, slowly decomposes and releases its carbon. There's been some really important studies that have been done that show that I think the timber industry has been trying to pitch this idea that, well, by logging our forests and turning trees into timber, into lumber, into furniture, we can store the carbon of our forests in chairs and tables and, you know, the framing of our houses. And it doesn't actually work that way. 85% of the carbon in forests is released when they're logged. Only 15% remains in lumber that actually, you know, ends up in products.
So let's say my house is made of lumber. Actually, my house is very old, and it was probably all old growth. I mean, I know it was huge trees that they built that house in 1907.
Oh, wow.
So is the siding in my house, the cedar siding, still storing carbon after 115 years?
It's still storing carbon, but the trees that, you know, the forest that those shingles came from, 85% of the carbon was released. Very little of it actually ends up in wood. The vast majority is released because there's not a lot of, especially on these, you know, private timber plantations. I mean, maybe a little bit less so with logging primary forests, although we need to stop doing that for, you know, another whole host of reasons. But with these timber plantations that are grown where trees are only growing for 50 years, there's not that much usable wood in these trees, and all the branches get shaved off, the roots get left behind, the bark gets cut off. So there's a lot of waste, even just when logs are processed in mills, there's a lot of sawdust. There's just so much waste in that process. I mean, quote unquote waste, that only a fraction of the actual carbon that's in the forest remains in, you know, your shingles or your wooden table.
I'm also thinking that back in 1907, I don't think they had the same kind of forestry practices that we have now. And
no.
Perhaps it was a lot more benign for the forest.
I mean, there was a lot of really, you know, the primary forest logging was really detrimental. It's really hard for, especially when forests are converted from native forests that have been growing for hundreds or thousands of years, when they're converted into these really intensively managed short rotation tree farms. They lose the ability to store a lot of carbon. And I mean, I think that's what we've seen as the primary forests have been cut, as the timber industry is, and the timber lands are increasingly owned by these, you know, Wall Street investment firms. They're focused on growing profits and money. They're not focused on growing trees. And, you know, so there are aerial herbicide sprays. They only replant one kind of tree because that kind of standardization, you know, is easier for the infrastructure and mechanisms of international capitalism to function with and to utilize. So there's timber plantations, privately owned timber plantations are not, I mean, they are forests in a sense, but they're incredibly degraded. There's not a lot of biodiversity. They don't store a lot of water. You know, there's the potential for forests to recover and become old growth once again, but there's a lot of work that has to happen. I mean, frankly, a lot of it is us doing less in the forest. And certainly there's a role for humans to play. Obviously, indigenous people have been on this continent helping manage and working with the land and forests for since time immemorial. But that's a very different idea of management, I think, than, you know, what folks like Weyerhaeuser are doing.
Well, let's talk about the change in the company structure and maybe the corporate focus of these companies that now own, that are now the forestry companies. I think we think back to the days, I think it was Roseburg Forest Products. Right, yeah. Which I think people in Southern Oregon that I know were not totally crazy about the company when it was locally owned. But actually a different one was the company down in Northern California that became, that bought up by Maxim, which is a mega company from Texas. But before that, it was a locally owned and very community-oriented logging company. So let's talk about that shift that's happened over the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah. So in Oregon, just some context, there's 4.4 million acres of forest land are in private industrial ownership in Western Oregon here. And approximately 62% of that, about 2.8 million acres, are in TIMO or REIT status. So I'm going to drop some acronyms here. TIMO stands for Timber Investment Management Organization, and REIT stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. And these are corporate structures that increasingly the timber industry has shifted to. And so this is like some history here. And the reason, you know, logging companies have shifted to this corporate structure is because it helps them maximize their financial returns. And part of the bigger picture strategy for them doing that over the last, you know, 20, 30 years has been lowering regulatory and taxation costs through utilizing their political power and influence and, you know, campaign contributions, adopting exploitative labor practices that harm workers and communities, which obviously is a change again. You know, a lot of these towns, rural towns across the Northwest grew up and were very dependent on timber economies. And for a long time, the wealth and money generated by that industry went back into the local communities. And that's something that we're seeing change. And I can talk more about that in a minute. A big thing is also these companies are using financial cut cycles that actually lower timber production and result in landscapes of small, low-carbon storage plantations, but that make more money for their investors. And we're also seeing these companies then buying out smaller landowners, which, again, helps depopulate rural areas and reduces tax base and harms local economies. So REITs and TIMOs are structured, again, as investment trusts, essentially. And shifting to REIT and TIMO status allowed these large industrial forest landowners to pay dramatically lower taxes federally.
Why is that?
because it's taxed differently. It's a different, I mean, it's a different kind of entity, so they fall into a different tax category than, you know, traditional logging companies. But it's not just federal taxes. At the same time this was happening, there was this transition to REITs and TIMOs, which dramatically lowered the federal tax burden for these companies. There were some major changes in Oregon state tax policy that had a huge impact. Which was between 1990 and 2005, a series of changes dramatically lowered the tax burden, the property taxes and the harvest taxes, which are both Oregon state taxes. They were reduced by about 80%, which meant that there was a lot less money going to local governments for things like schools, for county services, education. Things like mental health. You know, we're seeing, the last decade I've been living in Southern Oregon, and we've been hugely impacted by it down there. There's so little money coming in compared to what the county had gotten used to over, you know, the 20th century to support local services. And that's been really detrimental to those local communities. So this transition, I mean, so both the reduction in state harvest taxes and property taxes between 1990 and 2005, exempting themselves from a lot of federal corporate tax that they would otherwise have to pay, corporate income tax, has allowed these companies to make so much more money. You know, they're paying a lot less in taxes, so more of it just is profit for them. And at the same time, that's been devastating to local economies across the region.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFT, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer for the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about the vital importance of trees in a climatic chaotic world, and how to shift the emphasis back to putting forests over profits. I recall there's a company, I'm not sure they're still in this form, called SDS Lumber, which was, I think, based in the Gorge, actually. But they owned a lot of property in the Coast Range. And actually, they owned some property adjacent to where my friends used to have a farm in Gaston.
Okay.
And I recall something changed, and they started not just logging, but actually selling off the land for real estate development. So I wonder if this is also connected to what you're talking about.
Yeah, to some extent, I think certainly. I mean, again, these are not companies that see themselves as, we're here to grow timber and cut it and supply wood to the economy. These are companies that see themselves as they're trying to maximize returns for their investors and shareholders, which actually means they produce less lumber. Because they're in a race, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. These financial owners cut trees based on the growth of money and compound interest and expected returns, not on the growth of trees, which sets up a race between the rate of natural tree growth and the growth of money using compound interest. And the trees lose this race at about 50 years, which means that, you know, these timber plantations, these trees are being cut at around 50 years of age and not being allowed to grow any older than that, which means there's actually less, you know, wood coming out of the forest. but yeah, and so if the housing market is such, obviously we're in an affordable housing crisis, if these owners feel that they can make more money by selling off the land for, you know, real estate development, like, you know, home development, rather than continuing to use it as timberland, then they'll do that. And you know, that can create even more problems. I mean, obviously we need more housing, but when more and more of that housing is further out from towns and what we call the wildland urban interface, that puts those communities and those homes at greater risk for wildfire, greater exposure to that. And what we've seen even in California and Florida now, with large insurance companies backing out of the market in areas where climate disasters are becoming more frequent and more intense, homeowners end up stranded. And if a fire comes through, then they're, you know, may not be able to rebuild and may not get a payout from their company, the insurance company, if their home's burned down.
Now, I recall when I first came to Oregon many years ago that there were a number of different, basically locally based timber companies. And then there was Warehouse and Crown Zella back, and the other one, we had a skyscraper named after them. They were based in Georgia Pacific, went back and forth between being based in Portland and being based in Atlanta. Now, I'm wondering, are the large companies still in the game, and are they doing what you're talking about? And then what happened to the smaller companies, like Publishers Papers, which was one of the major timber companies in Clackamas County?
I think the story of the timber industry over this period from starting, you know, kind of the early 90s, late 80s, up, you know, through the early 20th century mirrors what we've seen in all kinds of other industries throughout our economy with the rise of neoliberal capitalism, and that increasingly smaller locally based companies are being bought out and consolidated into these really, really huge firms. So Weyerhaeuser is a real estate investment trust. And we saw, I mean, we're seeing more of that, the consolidation that's been going on. So there's, yeah, there's just fewer small locally based companies. And especially as the market has become more global, it's harder for those smaller companies to compete, especially, you know, smaller companies tend to, I mean, I think across industries, treat their workers better and be less exploitative and be more rooted in a community and feel a greater sense of obligation to, you know, maintain a reputation in the community. I think there's a lot to unpack there about how well they actually do that, or if that's the best way to support local economies and communities. But I think more so certainly than these large companies like Weyerhaeuser or Sierra Pacific Industries, now is the largest landowner in the United States. They just bought up Seneca Jones. So yes, it is definitely consolidated in that sense. I think it mirrors a lot of, you know, what we've seen elsewhere, where local companies are being bought up and displaced by these large multinational corporations.
And it also seems that their logging practices have really changed. And just from my own experiences, yeah, in Publishers Papers, I used to live not that far from this big plot they had, mm-hmm, in Eagle Creek. And it was beautiful forest. I wouldn't probably call it old growth, but it was pretty old. And it was like that until Publishers Papers actually got, I think, bought out by a Japanese company.
Mm-hmm.
And they just went in and clear-cut it all. And I know the same thing started happening in the Redwoods in Mendocino County.
Yep.
So I wonder, as much as I think people weren't really fond of any of these logging companies, if we look back to the good old days, what is there that's lost that we would rather see the timber industry be doing these days?
Yeah, I mean, again, it comes back to, I think, this race that these investor-owned and, you know, oriented companies set up between the rate of tree growth and the growth of compound interest and the return on investment. And they're not interested in letting forest plantations grow to, you know, be as large as possible to get as much lumber out as possible. They're certainly not interested in managing forests to maximize water storage, water quality, and carbon sequestration or biodiversity. Obviously, they're focused exclusively on growing profits, not on growing forests. So even though, you know, there's plenty to say and plenty of critique to be had around the way that industrial forest companies were managing lands in the second half of the 20th century, things have gotten worse in a lot of ways. And not just for the land, but also increasingly we're seeing the workforce as well. This, you know, the timber industry used to be a unionized workforce. There used to be a lot more jobs, and mechanization has been brought in. Increasingly, there's more export of raw logs. Things aren't processed as locally. So again, yeah, they're focused on how do we get the greatest rate of return on investment, and that happens in, you know, less than 50 years. So that means these plantations are increasingly, you know, the rotations have shrunk in that sense.
Well, let's talk about this conference that's going to be happening at the end of the month.
Yeah.
At the World Forestry Center. I have a recollection that they've been having these they've been having these industry focused conferences for years.
Yeah.
I think they were called something else before. So I want to talk first about what is the through line through what have all these conferences have been about, and then what's different with this one.
I mean, I think the through line is these are for-profit corporate capitalist companies. So the through line is how can we make as much money as possible, and how can we manage our forest lands in ways that make as much money as possible? How can we best influence the political environment to minimize regulation, minimize taxation, things like that? I think who will own the forest again is like a real exemplar of this shift to Wall Street investor-based forest management, which again is focused on maximizing returns for investors and nothing else. But also I think we're seeing with Who Will Own the Forest this year increasingly, as things like the climate emergency become more salient publicly and there's more political buy-in more widely to address that, and a growing sense of the scale of what that's going to take, and also an awareness about the role that, you know, so-called natural climate solutions, which is just ecosystems, can provide in minimizing the damages and harms and mitigating the impacts of climate change. We're also seeing, you know, at this this conference, Hool in the Forest, this year, there's also a big focus on carbon offsetting, net zero pledges, and how, you know, and how these financial forestry firms can get in the game on that, and also biomass. I think these companies are always looking for ways to create new revenue streams, and if they can continue managing their forests to maximize profit and also be taking in money from companies like Microsoft and Google for carbon offsets that they're selling, great for them. That's just more profit. And also, you know, there's, I think, because of the movement that's been building to manage forests differently and address climate change in a fundamental way, these companies are looking for ways to greenwash and brand themselves as part of the solution. And I think that's part of the net zero carbon offset thing is part of that. But also, there's some biomass companies that are going to be at the conference later this month, including Drax, which is one of the largest biomass companies in the world. And they, you know, in British Columbia, they cut old growth forests there, primary forests, and turn them into wood pellets. Their business model is literally burning trees. But that's another way that I think logging companies or these financial forestry companies in the industry is looking to pivot and brand themselves as part of the solution. Well, we can grow trees and they'll absorb carbon dioxide and then we'll burn them for energy and that's net zero, which isn't true. That's not how the carbon cycle really works. But it sounds good on paper and it allows them to brand themselves as part of the solution.
Well, before we get to the this new style of greenwashing that's, I guess, a big part of this conference, I want to talk about the traditional players. Mm-hmm. And in the on your website, you talk about how this brings together some of the biggest climate polluters, corporate forest clear cutters, and false climate solution peddlers. So let's talk about who, first of all, are the biggest climate polluters.
So two of the big ones that are going to be at this conference, one is J.P. Morgan, J.P. Morgan Chase, which seems to take pride in funding and investing and, you know, giving loans to every big polluting project. I've lost track of all the fossil fuel projects. They seem to be involved in just about every major pipeline and fossil fuel development project that's come up in the last few years. But also there are some actual oil companies. British Petroleum is going to be there. And they actually own or are the majority stakeholder in a firm called Finite Carbon, which is one of these carbon offset companies selling carbon offsets, which I think is really revealing, you know, that these companies, they understand that addressing climate change in a real way means the end of their business model. And so oil companies are buying up startup carbon market companies because that a lot of the net zero pledges that have come out in the last, you know, 5 years from big corporate firms rely entirely on carbon offsets and buying carbon offsets. So they're, you know, buying up these companies to just have them in-house. I think, so when we say big polluters, I think a lot of people think of, you know, fossil fuel companies, obviously, and
in fact, they're going to be there.
They are going to be there. Yeah, exactly. But also, to be honest, again, given that industrial plantation forestry is a major source of carbon pollution, the largest in Oregon, I think it's fair to call firms like Weyerhaeuser and SPI and Green Diamond, you know, what started as more traditional logging companies that have largely transitioned into this REIT and TIMO status, they're also big polluters. They're just not burning fossil fuels. They're cutting down forests and managing them in ways that release huge amounts of climate pollution.
Well, I think it's interesting. I'm thinking about the whole evolution of the forest movement, mm-hmm. where I don't think 40 years ago, during Redwood Summer, mm-hmm. that people were thinking about forests in terms of climate chaos.
Yeah.
We were aware of it, but we, and I think people kind of just took it for granted. Well, of course, forests are carbon sinks, and but we were thinking about all these other reasons.
I mean, yeah.
And that's now the forefront. And I find it interesting that this conference is playing on that. But in this, I've been reading about this new book that Naomi Klein is coming out with called Doppelganger,
yeah. mm-hmm.
about her relationship with Naomi Wolf, the other Naomi, and talking about how these doppelgangers are kind of like reflections of yourself, but through the filter of evilness.
Yeah.
And just everything being off. And that's what it feels like to me, that this is, you'd be having a conference on one side talking about forests and who will own the forest, meaning we'll get to what that conference will be about. But on the other hand, this is like every evildoer I can think is coming together. It feels kind of like a Batman movie.
Yes, it does. It's a real nexus of bad corporate actors. And I think it's also an opportunity to highlight the way that at the root of a lot of this is the financialization of nature. And I mean, a lot of these big corporate firms like BP and, you know, JP Morgan Chase and Microsoft and Google, they all talk a big game publicly about, you know, climate change and being part of the solution. And yet I think they largely see climate change as a technical problem that needs technical solutions, that essentially we have an unlucky fluke with atmospheric chemistry, and it just so happens that the byproducts of, you know, our way of life are going to cook the planet alive. And so what we need to do is just change where energy comes from, but we don't really need to change much else. And I think, you know, frontline communities, indigenous communities, and the climate movement are trying to, and the forest defense movement are increasingly trying to say, we do need technical changes, but beneath that, climate change and the climate crisis is really a political problem and a relational problem. That it's a political problem in the sense of who has power in our society. And right now, it's these companies like Google and Microsoft and JP Morgan Chase that have the money and the power, and they get to determine what happens and set the rules. And even underneath that, it's a relational problem in the sense that we have a broken relationship with the natural world, with forests, with ecosystems. And yes, we need those political changes. Yes, we need those technical changes. But more deeply, we need to address this fundamental relationship and these companies' desires to, you know, financialize nature and put a dollar sign and price on everything from, you know, what the market value of forests, the market value of clean water, how can we calculate the market value of the carbon storage potential of our forests, and then use that metric to determine whether it's, you know, more profitable or better to leave them standing or to cut them down. And, you know, so I think that's at the root of a lot of this stuff. And I think in a way that they may not have intended or expected, the Who Will Own the Forest conference and these companies all coming together really highlights those deeper, more fundamental issues here.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alex Bug, Alliance Organizer for the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about the vital importance of trees in a climate chaotic world and how to shift the emphasis back to putting forests over profits. Well, let's talk about what you guys are going to be doing. There's sort of going to be another Who Will Own the Forest conference happening. Where is it going to be happening in relationship to the one at the World Forestry Center?
Yeah, so this Who Will Own the Forest conference, like we've been talking about, is happening September 26th through the 28th. The forest defense and climate justice movements are coming together to mobilize around it and oppose it. You know, we need to send a message to these companies that financializing forests and managing them for profit instead of carbon storage and human rights and community benefit is a bad investment, and that resistance to those practices is growing, and that they should stop managing forests that way and stop investing in big polluting climate chaos causing industries and projects. So there's going to be two events that folks are organizing, and if anyone wants more information about this, you can go to forestsoverprofits.org, and there's lots more information there and ways to sign up and get, you know, details as more info comes out. But basically, there's going to be a big protest rally at the World Forestry Center on September 27th, Wednesday, September 27th, and then on Thursday, September 28th, there's going to be the Forests Over Profits conference, which is kind of pointing in a very different direction and talking about real solutions to the climate crisis and deforestation.
Are you going to have that at the Forestry Center too?
No, that's going to be at the Unitarian Church downtown in Portland from 10 to 5:30. And again, there's more details and you can sign up to come and get more information at forestsoverprofits.org. And we're going to be talking about the things that they aren't talking about at the World Forestry Center. Such as? So partly talking about the problems, but also talking about real solutions, which includes things like indigenous sovereignty and land back, traditional indigenous land management strategies, sustainable forestry, community forestry, some of these other models and ideas for ways to manage forests to maximize community benefit and local economic benefit, carbon storage, water quality, all those kinds of things. And that's the idea, is really to point to a different vision that currently these industrial private forest lands are being managed for the profit of these Wall Street investors all over the world and these large corporations, instead of for the benefit of communities, our forests themselves, and our climate.
Well, you mentioned basically the financialization of the forests, and it reminds me of back a number of years ago when people started talking about cap and trade as a way to deal with offsetting carbon emissions. I think George Shultz was a big backer of that, as I recall. And I heard people who consider themselves environmentalists who are talking about how you have to put a monetary value on everything in order for it to be taken seriously. So we're now about 30 years out from when I think that was starting to be the conversation. I wonder, do you feel like there was any validity to that at all, or was that really taking us down the wrong road?
I think it was certainly taking us down the wrong road. I mean, I think I'm reminded of something Ursula K. Le Guin said about, you know, capitalism seems inevitable and inescapable. And so did the divine right of kings. And yet we've overcome that. So these systems like capitalism, where within the logic of capitalism, everything has to have a price on it. That's what makes anything legible within capitalism as having any value. And the argument there, like you're saying, goes, well, if we want forests to be protected, if we want, you know, climate solutions, if we want clean water, we have to figure out how to put a monetary price on those things so that they can be internalized into the market. I think within the logic of capitalism, maybe that is what's required. I think we can do a lot more and have a much better world if we're willing to question whether we should be staying within the logic of capitalism or looking to move beyond that.
Well, it has seemed to me for a very long time that the logic of capitalism is fatally flawed. And, I mean, you look at the whole idea of inevitable and constant forever growth. There's an issue with that. It's called cancer, basically. So those are some of the problems I think that we're dealing with to begin with. But I also see interesting things where you do see some corporations coming on board in serious ways to really confront climate chaos because of their financial concerns. I mean, even the Department of Defense, yes, has recognized the climate crisis is going to cost them a lot of money. So I wonder how we balance that, and then we'll get into how we do that in the forest as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. And I don't know that big questions that big have only one answer. I mean, again, I come back to, I think that we need to financialize everything and calculate the costs. I think that can be useful as a way currently for communicating the scale of the problem, the depth and severity of the mess that we're in or walking into. But I also don't think that that in itself is a solution. Again, beneath that, there's these deeper questions around our broken relationship to the natural world and each other, you know, it's not just forests and clean water and carbon that we want to put a price on. It's increasingly, you know, like social media companies, big tech companies find a way to financialize and put a price on relationship and attention. Again, I think like, the Department of Defense saying, well, it's going to cost us this much climate change, you know, based on, you know, however many degrees of warming, can be useful for a way of like visibilizing the scale of the problem. But I think to really get at it and change things at a fundamental level, more than just tweaks around the edges, we're going to have to let go and walk away from that urge to put a price on everything. I think that is, you know, a kind of core part of the problem in a way.
Well, this is one of the things that I think about a lot, and I just wonder, how do we get there? And I'm wondering how you see this conference that you're organizing and the rally the day before at this Who Will Own the Forest conference, how that can help us to start seeing the planet and the universe in a wholly different way. I mean, this Friday is the big climate strike, the international climate strike, which I'm very excited about. And young people, even younger than you, are in the streets, like really getting it. So there is a growing number of people, particularly under 30, who I think are getting it because their lives are at stake.
Right.
And I wonder how that gets translated so that we can get beyond this whole bubble of finances and see something like a spiritual core, which is so much more intrinsic and so much more vital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think even just looking back at the successes of the conservation and forest defense movement in, you know, the latter part, last couple decades of the 20th century, the reason we still have old growth standing on public lands is because people fought for it. That didn't just happen. It was because people built grassroots, powerful movements put pressure on political and elected leaders and the companies doing the logging and made it, with the companies and the corporations doing those things, they undercut the social license there made the political costs for the elected leaders and folks in power who have, you know, the power to make changes to things like, you know, forest practices and forest management policies on public lands. The movement made the cost of not doing anything, of not, you know, changing the rules, of not protecting forests higher than the cost of going along with what made the company's money. And I think, you know, that's what the climate movement is increasingly moving to, and just seeing the way that it shifted from... I first got active in the climate movement in 2006, 2007, after seeing Inconvenient Truth. I was 14. And that era of the climate movement was very much the cap and trade bill, the, you know, Markey bill of 2009. It was very much more focused on market solutions, big business within, you know, how can we not have to change anything fundamental? And I think what we've seen in the decades since, and especially over the last 5 years with the growth of this really powerful grassroots youth-led climate movement, is a greater realization of we have to build up the political power to force the changes that we need. That, you know, the people in power who are the same people and invested in all these companies who are profiting from the way things are, we're not going to persuade them or convince them to see the light. It's really got to be grassroots people power movements that force those changes.
I'm thinking like one of the big examples of this conundrum is Joe Biden, who's an interesting guy. He is probably the most climate conscious and climate active president we've ever had. And yet he has to fold to he's playing this game. And part of it is, I think he's old school. I think he still has his 5 bazillion years of experience working with all these corporate entities. And then the other one is the political reality that he's up against, which is really, really challenging.
Sure, yeah.
So I wonder, what do we do with Joe Biden? I mean, I think that he's an interesting case to look at. And when I feel optimistic, I think about all the really important things that he gets.
Yeah.
Way more than Obama,
mm-hmm.
you know, who's quite a bit younger than him. But I wonder how we move to that next step, to where we help the Joe Bidens of the world to dismantle those things that right now are holding them back from really realizing the stuff that they do get.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's instructive to look at, like, you know, obviously... there have been some big, some major, very significant climate wins, let's call them, over the last 3 or 4 years. I think the reason that Joe Biden has done anything like that is because of these grassroots movements. Like, if it hadn't been for, you know, groups like Sunrise and the climate strike, I don't think Joe Biden would have felt the pressure to go to bat so hard for things like the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think the fact that, you know, obviously he's done things on the other side of the spectrum too, approving the Willow Project in Alaska, approving the Mountain Valley Pipeline, opening up new leases for fossil fuel drilling on public lands. Even just this last week, the Biden administration canceled, I think, 6 or 7 oil drilling leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I don't know that he would have done that if people hadn't been making such a ruckus and putting so much pressure on him over the terrible things he did with Mountain Valley Pipeline and the Willow Project. So I think even when we've seen those wins, it's not because we have an elected leader who's just, you know, knows all the right things and cares really deeply. I think politicians, they respond to pressure. And if they think that they're going to pay a higher cost for ignoring, you know, these grassroots movements in favor of their, you know, big campaign contributors who are include oil companies and fossil fuel companies and the banks that are funding these projects. I think when we win, it's because grassroots movements have built up the power and pressure to force politicians, including Joe Biden, to go against the will of some of their, you know, big financial backers and folks that, you know, are very much within the same system and the same institutions that, you know, they really believe in and have been a part of, in Joe Biden's case, for, I don't know, 50 years or however long.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer for the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about the vital importance of trees and protecting trees in this climate chaotic world, and how to shift the emphasis from trees for profit for trees for forests and for the rest of us and for the planet.
Yeah.
Well, I want to give Biden one more accolade before we go back to bashing him. But I mean, also, he created that monument, the National Monument, next to the Grand Canyon, which mm-hmm. is something that's been needing to happen for a really long time. And his statements for doing that and getting it, and it was also particularly indigenous pressure. That
yeah.
really, so I really hand that to him. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, with the wonderful Inflation Reduction Act that has all kinds of great climate stuff, it also has a very heavy emphasis on carbon capture and sequestration
yes.
and carbon offsets.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about some of those flaws. And
yeah.
and those people, you mentioned earlier in the show that those people are going to be in full force at this Who Will Own the Forest conference.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and again, there's, I think, over the last however many decades, the forest conservation, forest defense movement, and the climate movement have increasingly, or have largely been kind of in separate rooms. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, overlapping issues and concerns, but they've been kind of distinct movements. And I think what we're seeing more now, and this is a big part of the work that the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance does, is trying to bridge those movements. And find the intersections there and work together. And I think that's necessary to build larger and more powerful coalitions and movements. But also just because these things aren't that separate. We know that forests and carbon and climate change are very interlinked and influence each other in big ways. And so do these companies. So yeah, carbon capture and storage, and I mean, it's in this kind of false solutions bucket that includes carbon markets and offsets, bioenergy, biomass, and what's called BECCS of bioenergy, carbon capture and storage.
Jim, yeah. first thing, because sure. you mentioned biomass, and I think people might not understand what it is, so let's just do a little sidebar about okay. what biomass is.
Biomass is burning trees for electricity.
Like they used to do in Vermont.
Yeah, I think they still do. They do in a lot of parts of the world. Yeah, so at the big biomass company that's going to be at the Who Will Own the Forest conference later this month is Drax, which is based in the UK, but they also have operations in British Columbia and in the southeast US in Georgia, Mississippi, kind of the Gulf Coast southeast area. And they're trying to break into the Pacific Northwest. So they actually, Drax has a proposal right now that to build a new wood pellet factory, facility, and export terminal in Longview, Washington, just down the river from Portland here. So the way biomass works is companies cut down trees, turn them into sawdust, essentially grind them up, press them into tiny little pellets. Some people, that's probably less of a thing in Portland, but many people have wood pellet, wood-fired stoves. So instead of putting in like a big chunk of firewood, there's these tiny wood pellets that drop in and burn. And it's similar to that, only instead of heating a home, it's, you know, providing electricity to cities. So it's the wood pellets are being burned to, I mean, in many cases, heat water for steam to turn turbines to generate electricity.
I find that interesting because there was a while where we used to think, back in the days when I used to heat with wood, mm-hmm. it was very, you know, it was a very safe and environmentally conscious way to heat. And then we started learning about all the pollution, the carbon monoxide that comes
yeah.
out, not to mention the carbon dioxide that comes out. Mm-hmm. And cities have really moved to really reduce wood-burning stoves. First,
yeah.
it was putting catalytic converters on them, and now it's really discouraging them totally. So it's interesting that on the one hand, cities and some other, you know, larger entities are trying to shut down biomass. On the other hand, they're also encouraging it to, like, fuel their power plants. So I find that a kind of a contradiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think homeowner, you know, individual people in a home with a wood stove to stay warm in the winter don't tend to have the pocketbooks to write large campaign contributions in the way that companies like Drax do. So I think that might have something to do with the contradiction there.
Well, let's get back to the carbon offsets and the two things that are interesting, carbon capture and storage, which I don't there, I think, in this discussion is really that the forests are one of the finest places to do carbon capture and sequestration, along with wetlands, which have been just deregulated by the EPA.
Right.
But let's talk about offsets, because there it seems like there's this fluid market that nobody understands, and that I mean, it used to be like you get an order an airplane ticket, and you could pay an extra $10 or something, and you got your greenwashing.
Yeah.
And at the time, I thought, this doesn't make a lot of sense. And later on, I found out that my gut sense was right. It doesn't.
Yes, you're
and
correct.
I was talking to this guy, Rich Flevin, who was saying that actually, if you were going to pay the amount of carbon you're creating, it would be like a $50,000 ticket, not adding $10 to the ticket.
Right.
But this is what's going on, I mean, in ways that I'm just barely beginning to understand.
Yeah, and the carbon market, especially with forest carbon offsets, it's more of a thing in other parts of the world than the U.S., although there is a carbon market, forest carbon market offset program and market in California. I mean, to cut to the chase, it's a scam. It doesn't work. It doesn't reduce emissions, and research is increasingly showing that it doesn't protect forests, actually. There was a big expose that came out in The Guardian earlier this year that showed the largest carbon market offset certifier, I believe, in the world, called a company called Verra. The Guardian and several other investigative journalists found that 90% of their carbon offsets were worthless, that they did not represent any actual meaningful reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, that it's really just a scam, and it's a way for companies like BP and Shell and JP Morgan Chase and Microsoft to write a check and get to say that they're net zero. But those markets are largely unrated. They're unregulated. They're voluntary. These big polluters write checks to forest landowners and get to say that they're net zero, but it's not actually translating on the ground into real carbon reductions. And like, there's a whole rabbit hole we can go down with that, which
let's
might be more than we have time for.
Let's go just a little ways down the rabbit hole.
Sure.
Because I find it's really interesting, like as an example of one of the other big boondoggles is biogas, which comes from factory farms.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to a couple of people where if Northwest Natural says that they're getting, they call it renewable natural gas from a farm, and they're decreasing carbon dioxide pollution and methane pollution in Oregon, in reality, they're paying an offset, and the farm is in Nebraska.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to wrap my brain around, how does that all work?
I mean, it's this financialization of the world. It's trying to turn the world into an accounting ledger. And the world isn't that simple, it turns out. I mean, with forests, and carbon capture and storage, I mean, a useful analogy that I've heard. As one example, BECCS, Bioenergy Carbon Capture and Storage, one quote-unquote solution that's been put forward by a lot of big polluters, including it's actually been in some of the COP talks and the UN climate negotiations. And the idea is we'll grow forests or cereal crops, harvest them, burn them for energy, and then we'll have these theoretical, don't actually exist yet, devices that capture all the carbon that's emitted when we burn them, and we'll bury that underground. And because when those trees or crops are growing, they're absorbing carbon dioxide, this is a net a way of reducing carbon. This is a way of pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. In reality, if we leave forests alone, they'll store tons of carbon. They do it well on their own. They don't need us to like micromanage it in this way. And increasingly, I think the evidence is becoming clear that the more that we try and micromanage nature and put a price on everything and calculate it and, that level of control, we're not actually good at that. It doesn't work. It's like a fish tank. If you've ever had a fish tank, it's a lot of work. You have to keep the water at just the right temperature and use a bunch of chemicals and keep the pH balanced and clean the tank and, put in fake plants and things and you're simulating a real ecosystem. Ponds do that and lakes for free, and they do it much better than we could ever do it. And I think that's, I don't know, that's an analogy that I think of with this. We're going to hypermanage everything and, you know, these carbon offsets. It's treating the world like a fish tank when we have ponds and lakes. And if we just stopped polluting them, we could get the same benefits. Nature does it better than we could. So getting out of the way is really needed.
I think that's a great analogy. So one last time, what can people do on September 27th and 28th?
On September 27th, come out to a big mobilization protest at the World Forestry Center. And then on September 28th, come to the Forests Over Profits Conference from 10 to 5:30 at the Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. And you can get more information and sign up for both those things at forestsoverprofits.org.
And I'll have that link on the Locus Focus website.
Great.
Alex, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah,
and
thanks so much.
I really appreciate you pinch hitting today. And this has just opened up a whole new can of worms.
Yeah, certainly more to talk about.
Yeah, so I'd love to have you on again and we can go more into depth about the work that you're doing. So once again, thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer for the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kbuo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kbuo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air and helping us get back live in the station again, but helping all us volunteers who haven't gotten back in the station make the best possible radio that we can. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kbuo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Thanks, Ray. Next week, we'll talk with Bob Salinger with Willamette Riverkeeper about Portland's proposed floodplain resilience plan. We'll go out with music by the Grateful Dead. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and you might want to start wearing a mask again.
If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my tunes were played on the harp unstrung, would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand-me-down. The thoughts are broken. Perhaps they're better left unsung. I don't know. Don't really care. Let there be songs to fill the air. Rippled in still water, when there is no pebble tossed, nor wind to blow, reach out your hand. If your cup be empty, if your cup is full, may it be again. Let it be known there is a fountain that was not made by the hands of men. There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn
and the dark of night. And if you go, no one may follow. That path is for your steps alone. When there is no pebble tossed, no wind to blow, you choose to lead, must follow. But if you fall, you fall alone. If you should stand, then who's to guide you? If I knew the way, I would take you home. La da da da, la da da da.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month only, the Governance and Policy Committee will meet on Tuesday, September 12th at 6 p.m. instead of the third Tuesday. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah.